The more aggressive and optimistic the CEO, then the more cautious the CFO should be. The CFO is there to report on the facts and not necessarily be swayed by any emotion or any excessively positive ambitions going forward.
Welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, we're going to talk about something I've wanted to talk about for a long time, management buyouts, MBOs. So we all know most businesses die. That's the famous stat out there. Some of them get sold, but there's actually a third door, a third way to pass your business on to another generation or another set of management, which doesn't involve selling it to someone externally. And it doesn't involve, well, watching it just dwindle to nothingness. I guess it's a middle way. To talk about this topic, I've invited us to Carl Lloyd today, a very experienced CFO who's actually had a lot of hands-on experience with this process and what it is. And today we're going to chat about his experience in executing a successful MBO. We're going to try and learn some lessons from that. So maybe if this is something that's coming up in your professional career, you can reference back to and maybe take some advice from. So Carl, thanks very much for coming to the show. Maybe you could just introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background.
Thanks, James. I'm Carl. I qualified back in the day with EY and then did mainly commercial roles with Matalan and the co-op before going on the more traditional financial controller route. And then landed my first FD role with ITC, which is a luxury travel business down in Chester. I was there for 8 years. Yeah, it's there where we did a technically called a BIMBO, a buy-in management buyout, which was interesting. And then a couple of years later, we flipped that traditional MBO to private equity. Since then, I've worked with kind of smaller businesses, spent a few years in e-commerce. And then latterly, I enjoy working with smaller businesses, with entrepreneurs, really helping them grow the business and improve processes, improve reporting. So that kind of led to the fractional route, part-time finance director for a portfolio of clients, doing that for 3 or 4 years now.
Let's go over the basics here. What is it exactly when someone wants to do an MBO, or what leads to this? Why might someone consider an MBO versus other options on the table?
Yeah, so I mean, there can be a variety of reasons. One of the main reasons is to de-risk. You've got the business to a really good level. Obviously, the risk is that doesn't continue and you tail off. So a lot of companies do like to de-risk, owners like to de-risk, take some cash out of the table, sell some of the shares while still maintaining a proportion of the shares going forward. However, in this case, we did sell it in the end to private equity. It was a majority sale. And that is because, you know, the owners want to, get on with their lives in a different sphere.
Yeah. Okay. So it's very common that, you know, people who start a business, if you're lucky enough to get it up and going, most of their net worth will be tied up in that business. And it's a very illiquid market for, especially, I suppose, at the smaller and mid-size range. Like, buying and selling a business happens, but it's not as easy as buying and selling a house, a lot more so. And your options are limited. You're either a rocket ship, you're going fast, you're getting bigger, and maybe you'll have a big company that will come along to try and buy you, or strategic. But most businesses aren't like that, let's face it. So the majority are quote unquote normal, and maybe steadily growing or at a level. And this is a kind of a way. So technically then, what is it? Like, if someone who had never heard of this term before, I can understand why you might want to do it. You're a business owner, you've no option, no one wants to buy you for whatever reason, or their valuations aren't right. What does it mean when people say they're doing a BIMBO?
So it's a buy-in management buyout. So technically, your management team are buying into the company. So, you know, in our situation, we had a team established over 5 years, doing a great job. The business was family-owned. And the family had owned the business for 35 years, but wanted to transition away from the business and give the management team full control. So we ended up, well, the deal was a high net worth individual. So we actually did two management buyouts while I was there. The first time round, high net worth, one of our clients actually, bought into the business, bought a share. We took on some debt from a bank, and we use that cash to buy the shares of the owner.
So the feature of this is you have employees or previously employees. Typically, they don't have cash lying around to be able to buy the business, but you arrange it with the debt provider so that they can pay that back over 3 to 5 years, you know, so the owner can get a lump sum up front.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the debt provider comes along. If the business is worth, you know, let's say 10 million, you might have private equity putting in 5, the bank put in another 5, that goes to the owner. And then, yeah, you're paying that down over the next few years. As the business grows, the equity value of the business grows, that debt value actually shrinks. So the payback to the investor, the private equity firm, let's say, is, you know, much more than it would have been had it been 10 million of capital invested.
Well, you have three components here. You have the private equity firm, you have the management team who are given skin in the game, I guess, and they have to ensure the profits are there to service the loan. And the gambit for them is that if they manage to actually pay that loan off over 5 years, let's say, at the end of it, all they're left with the equity that's left. And then the private equity firm, why are they needed, or why were they used in this case? Why couldn't you just do it by just going straight to the bank saying, hey, I want whatever, 5 million for my staff to buy half, to do a buyout? Is a private investment needed for some reason?
Banks typically lend 2.5 times your EBITDA. So basically whatever profit you're making, you can only ever loan 2.5 times that. So if the value of the business is more than 2.5 times, then you need to find the cash somewhere else. And typically this is what, you know, private equity companies are all about. They look for opportunities for growing businesses where they can invest, they can empower the management team that's on board to, you know, like you say, achieve their targets, incentivized in the majority of cases by either shares or options in our case. You achieve your options, you vest your options based on achieving certain hurdles. So after 1 year, you might, if you hit your sales and profit targets, then you get a certain amount of options. Same again the following year, the year after. So your shareholding in the business builds so that you are incentivized to stay, to push the business forward successfully, so that in 3, 4, 5 years time, when the private equity firm decides to sell, that you have your share and, you know, you can monetize the time that you've been there and all the investment that you've made.
What about a bit about the story behind this one? Like what sort of age profile was the owner? Why did they want to get out? What sort of size was the business at?
Yeah, so it was about 30 million turnover when I started, and the owner was sadly quite ill with cancer. And, you know, shortly after I started, he actually passed away. Prior to that, though, he had put a new CEO in place who'd been with the business for 4 years already. So she knew what was going on within the business. She had a plan. I joined during the middle of the financial crisis in 2009. So it was, you know, tricky start, right in at the deep end. We just lost a third of our staff to redundancies. But, you know, those guys that remained really wanted to be part of the kind of regeneration of the business. So an exciting journey. Well, certainly in the early stages, it was re-establishing the reputation of the business, both with the regulatory bodies like the CAA and APTA, but also with the bank, setting out the plan for the next 3 years and then going back every month and delivering against that plan. You know, we said we'd do this, we've done it. So your reputation just starts to rebuild. So lots of fun in the first few years.
I'm smiling because if I had a dollar for every time I've heard a story of an FD going in for the new job to find out that something calamitous is about to happen, I think I'd have several dollars. Let's put it that way. It never seems to be they swap out the FD when things are fantastic. It's always at some precipitous point. And did you know what was in store for you before you joined, or was this something you discovered?
It was my first FD role, to be honest. I was a little bit green, but no, it was nothing major. You know, there's a few processes that we need to tweak, professionalize the team, improve reporting, you know, drive profitability. So all good, standard, exciting stuff to be cracking on with. But ultimately, the owner didn't necessarily want to be the owner of a travel company. You know, her husband had run it for 30 years, and she was not necessarily overly interested in being the face and the face and the owner of the business going forward. So the plans were put in place fairly early doors to look for a transition to new ownership.
You say professionalize the team, sounds like a checkbox, very easy to achieve, but were there awkward conversations to be had about the old team and roles? And how did you face up to that? I guess at a long-standing business, there were people who had been there a long time but weren't necessarily right to bring to the next level.
Yeah, do you know what? I think a lot of those guys went in the redundancies. So the team that I inherited were all keen to rebuild the business. But, you know, professionalize, the business had been run essentially as a lifestyle business for the owner. So not particularly worried about spend as long as there was money in the bank. But, you know, given that we were a travel business, we collect the money typically 3 months before anyone goes on holiday. So there's always going to be cash in the bank. But do you have enough to service all the liabilities? That was the key. And that's something that the CAA become a lot more interested in, is actually since the financial crisis. So yeah, we spent a lot of time running through the P&L and looking for opportunities to save money. Yeah, professionalizing the team, just looking at the processes and the ways that we work, putting processes in for everything. And, you know, there's just the standard finance, so monthly reconciliations, making sure all that was ticked off, and then liaising very closely with the auditors, particularly the first couple of years, to make sure that we were all correct. And then really after that, it was just, you know, looking at the improvements, you know, marginal gains that we can make month on month, improving the reporting, getting into the details of the data so that you're making decisions based on facts and data rather than gut feel. I think a lot of entrepreneurial businesses can actually get really far based on gut feel decisions. But, you know, there comes a stage when data really just needs to come to the fore.
It's amazing, actually, sometimes these businesses, I mean, 30, 40 million turnover, effectively being run on a cash basis by the sounds of it. And it got that far is pretty amazing, you know. So it sounds like all this happened not at the best time either, in the financial crisis. So a new CEO coming in. The debt was agreed. The repayments started having to come out of the bank account in the first month. How did the team manage to deal with that pressure that wasn't there before? You're going from a situation that sounded pretty idyllic and laid back, and now there was a serious bill to pay every month. Did it change the culture?
I mean, to be fair, that, you know, it took a couple of years for the first deal to happen. And, you know, during that time, we'd made a lot of improvements to the reporting, to the banking. So we were in a decent place, and obviously the bank would do their due diligence before they make any loans. But, you know, we had to report against certain covenants every month. So the bank, rather than just give you the money and hope that they get the repayments, they want you to report on, you know, debt service and liquidity, EBITDA cover every month, so that they can, you know, look at their little spreadsheet and say, yeah, so this business isn't really a risk, or we need to spend a little bit more time looking at these guys and maybe help them out. So you do your reporting, so you know well in advance that you can service that debt or not.
So you hear stories like, famously, Dave Ramsey. He's a finance influencer in the States, and his backstory is that he had a business, I think it was construction or maybe real estate, and then one day the bank just decides, no, you're no good anymore, Dave. We're calling it all in. Could that happen on this side of the pond? Could the bank have just withdrawn everything if the reporting wasn't what they wanted?
Yeah, I think there would be early warning signs. So if you started to miss your covenants, then, you know, there would be conversations, and those covenants could be renegotiated. That obviously comes at a cost. I don't think they could turn around one day and say, we want our money back. And, you know, in plenty of time, you could always try and renegotiate either with the bank or with a different bank or with a different lender.
And those covenants, I mean, what do they typically touch on? It's not just you're making a repayment or not. What else would they look at?
Yeah, so you're looking forward basically at the cash flow forecast to see, are you going to have enough money to make these repayments? And how much is going to be left? So they might set a cash figure of, say, 200 grand minimum spare cash, just to allow for, you know, if sales don't quite hit target, how much wriggle room do we have? And once you've paid off your interest, et cetera, you know, what percentage of EBITDA does this debt cover? So there's a few different metrics that they look at typically, just to give them a sense of comfort.
Let's talk rather about the CEO-CFO dynamic, which is often the CEO is hard charging, you know, not really looking at the details in the extreme, fake it till you make it. Sometimes it depends, you know, and then there's the counterbalance there of reality. What's your approach to managing a sort of an aggressive CEO like that, that's looking to work the angles, let's call it?
It's a fairly standard relationship. You know, the very ambitious CEO, and then, you know, the CFO is meant to be the merchant of doom. You know, always looking on the dark side. I think there's a balance. You know, the more aggressive and optimistic the CEO, then the more cautious the CFO should be. The CEO and I worked really well together. But yeah, it's very important that, you know, the CFO is there to report on the facts and not necessarily be swayed by any emotion or any excessively positive ambitions going forward. You know, we tend to set the budget right at the start, and the bank and the lenders will typically sign up to that. Any variations from that need to be agreed. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a case of, you know, the CEO says just put that up 10%. The covenants are looking a little bit dicey. Put sales up 10% because we've already agreed what the sales are going to be. Certain things built in just to make sure that the team can't completely make it up.
So this business then was sold ultimately again. Was that like a stepping stone then, because they'd gone through this experience, they demonstrated to be able to pay off the debt, et cetera, et cetera? Was it then more attractive as an acquisition target with a proven professional management team? Is that what helped?
Initially, the first transition was with a high net worth who clearly saw the opportunity to turn the business round from, you know, was family-owned business, you know, implement some new systems, upweight the reporting. We made an acquisition during the 2 years as well. So just to turn business A, for example, let's say new systems, new processes, and another acquisition into a much more sellable business B that would be more attractive to private equity. So, you know, from his angle, he bought his shares from the owner, spent some money over the 2 years, and then essentially this much better equipped business to go forward was sold to private equity 2 years later.
If someone came to you today and say, listen, I'm working on a finance team, we're looking at this sort of MBO strategy, or I've been asked to look at ways of bringing business forward, what advice would you give them in terms of advisors to bring on, or where to start, or what to watch out for?
Advisors are important because they do this on a day-to-day basis. You know, if you're an FD in an SME, you know, you're not necessarily talking to, venture capital or private equity every day, but these guys are, and they can help you firstly put the information memorandum together. Presumably, you've got a financial model already that works, and you can forecast for the next 5 years on that basis. But there's a lot of other information about the business that goes into the IM, or they will know who the best businesses are to speak to, private equity businesses are to speak to for your particular market, your size of business, but also personality. It's very important that you choose the right business. We actually saw 7 different private equity firms when we did this, 7 different meetings. You know, by the 7th one, we were a little bit exhausted. But you're just basically introducing each of them to the business. But equally as important is that they are introducing themselves to you, so you can get the measure of what kind of partner they're going to be going forward. Because they, you know, they're going to be working very closely with you through good times and bad over the next, you know, typically 5 years. So it's important that there is a good relationship there. But yeah, as if you're happy, the main thing is to be happy with your financials. If you can go back 2 years, look at all your balance sheet recs, look at your financial report, and you're happy with everything that's in there, then due diligence, etc., shouldn't be that painful.
And out of the 7 that you talked to, what made you pick the final one? I guess a certain number of them were not interested in acquiring the business, certain were, and then you got down to the last one where you both agreed. What were your criteria for deciding? How much was gut feel? How much was terms on the table? What made you go for them?
Generally, the terms would have been pretty similar. So it really is down to that relationship with the guys that will be sitting on your board going forward. And we found that one of the businesses was just a really good fit. You know, we all got on really well. You know, they were a little bit more pragmatic. They wouldn't be trying to, you know, dig into the detail. And that's another thing to take into consideration. Some PE firms like to have a man on the board, like to be involved on a regular basis in decision making. Others will take a step back and just, you know, leave the guys to run it as long as the report's coming through each month and there's no particular risks or issues to consider, then, you know, they're happy for you to run the business.
And did the original leadership team remain on that CEO, or did they bring a new team in?
Yeah, so as part of the first deal, we'd assembled a senior team. We ran it for 2 years, and then the majority of the team stayed and rolled some of their share options into the new deal. I actually took the opportunity to cash in my chips at that stage and sail on to new opportunities.
All right. Well, maybe that brings us nicely on then to what you're doing today and the sort of clients that you work best with, if you like.
Yeah. So like I said earlier, I do fractional CFO work at the moment. I mean, there's a million ways to talk about this. I work as a part-time finance director for a portfolio of businesses. They tend to be smaller businesses, SMEs for sure, less than 20, 25 million turnover. They're all ambitious. I think the mere fact that they want to or consider using a portfolio FD shows that they have that ambition. They want to succeed. And, you know, those are the guys that I really enjoy working with. Just going in there and stuff that I define as my bread and butter is, you know, what is this witchcraft type reaction from some of the clients? You know, we wouldn't have a clue how to put a cash flow forecast together. You know, that's what I do. So it's great to be able to go in there and add value from day one, but also add advice from, you know, 25 years experience in finance. There's so many opportunities to improve the business, to improve profitability, to improve reporting, relationships with the banks. So many things to go out where we can add value.
And do you find the relationships with the banks transfer across your clients? Are you able to... Have you found certain people easier to work with, or you know the industry that might you're able to introduce new business to them?
Yeah, particularly when it comes to fundraising. Having done it a few times now, you get to know what these guys are looking for. So you can quite often tweak or update, change the processes internally before you then go out to raise funds, so that the questions are easier, but that you have the answers and you're not necessarily digging any holes for yourself.
Okay, well, I have to ask then. So what are you referring to there when you say there's certain things they're looking for that you want to straighten out first?
One of the clients at the moment, they're looking for funding, and the finances aren't necessarily in the greatest order. They've had a bookkeeper, but no senior finance advice until this stage. So, you know, margin, for example, by month is quite volatile. There's no particular reason for that. So I'm at the moment going through their inventory management system to try and understand what stock came in, what was sold, try to either iron out the monthly margin variance or to explain it because of the mixing customers, mixing product, etc. So having those answers readily available will really help with a lender who's also looking at the books thinking, why is the margin so volatile? If you can explain that and saying going forward, you know, those higher margin customers are the ones we're going to focus on. And I think it's just having that robust financial model in place as well that you can explain that's underpinned by rational assumptions.
You know, your margin can be volatile, but they want their monthly or quarterly payment predictably. So it's a reasonable thing to look at, I guess. Before I ask my last traditional question here, how can people reach out to you or get in touch with you if they'd like to get some more advice on doing an MBO or maybe work with you in preparing their business for sale?
Yeah, so, you know, if there are any questions on anything I've talked about, then you can find me on LinkedIn, Carl Lloyd, or you can email me at carl@lloydconsultinglimited.com.
Some people squirm when I ask, but anyway, who's your business hero and why?
I had to think about this one because I didn't have one that immediately sprang to mind, but I do recall on a few occasions hearing either Sir John Timpson or his son, James, talking about how they run the business, and I do find it quite inspirational. So I'm going to say the Timpsons, the cobblers. And I guess there's a couple of reasons. They give people a second chance. You know, they're well known for employing people that have come out of prison. But on the other hand, they don't suffer fools. There's three pretty basic rules, and as long as you stick by those, you know, you're good. But they operate the three strikes policy. So if you make a mistake or you mess up, then there's your first strike, but they do offer, you know, a significant amount of support to help you get you back on the right track. Same for the second. you know, all that support is readily available. But yeah, third strike, you're out. So I like that because, you know, it's all well and good being all fluffy, but fluffy just doesn't necessarily lead to great results. You need that other side of the edge.
Maybe for listeners outside the UK who don't know what Timpson's is or even what a cobbler is, I guess. It's a family business, right? Second generation, I think.
I think it was set up by John back in the day. James has now taken over the running of it. And there are hundreds of high street stores that repair your shoes and cut your keys. So, yeah, it's a great business. And like I say, I think they run it really well. They really look after the staff. They've got holiday homes that they allow the staff to use, etc. Seems like a really good place to work. But like I say, they don't suffer fools.
Well, they have simple rules. Like the three rules are interesting. I'll probably get them wrong if I try and remember them. One is keep your hand out of the till. I remember that one. I think the second one is looked apart. That was it, yeah. And then they're empowered to do, you know, what they think is right for the customer. So, you know, to give a refund or...
They get an allowance every day that they can give someone their invoice for free just because they want to. Like, and customer service these days is absolutely paramount, isn't it? So I think if you can set yourself aside doing little things like that, that for that customer will be, you know, enormous. But for the business itself, It's a quick win.
If you have got this far into the podcast, well done. Congratulations. Thanks very much. If you are James Timpson and you're listening, then please reach out to me and I'd love to have you on and we can go deeper on your methodology. I think he's normally on Channel 4 and CNBC and stuff. So I'm not sure if he's going to be on the Growth Profit podcast.
I probably massively undersold you. Sorry, James.
We'll work on that. So this has been really cool. I've been wanting to talk to someone about MBOs for a long time and I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for your time, Carl.